probably not a topic that, off the bat, it might not be something that is necessarily attractive right away. It's a word that we don't always use. Saying that statement, I'm lonely, is not a statement that's... It's a very vulnerable statement. I think there's a lot of risk when we say that. And so we don't always talk about it in those terms. So before I dive in, I should say a little bit about me, I guess. So my name is Stephen Doucette Campbell. I work as a psychotherapist, which is just a fancy word, which is usually an intimidating word, but it's just a counselor, a mental health therapist working with Schilling Mental Health. So I've worked, it's about 12, 13 years now I've been working. I've been with Schilling just for coming up on 2 years in June. Before that, I actually worked in the world of addictions for the past 10 years almost. First in Winnipeg for several years in high schools and with families, and then when I came to Ontario in 2013, I've been working in St. Catharines mainly with adults in an outpatient counseling program. So I always say addictions is kind of what gets people in the door, and then once they're in there, there's a lot of other things that we're working with as far as the rest of life, mental health and family dynamics and mental health and physical health and all that. So, yeah, there's a lot to it, but that's what I've been doing the past few years. Currently, I'm working in the probation offices in Hamilton. It's a substance use contract, actually, but again, it really is, the work I do with clients is very broad, but working one-to-one and with a lot of mandated clients that are on probation. So it's an interesting job. Schilling itself, who's not familiar with Schilling at all? Is there anybody that's just never heard of it? Yeah. So we're Schilling Mental Health Network, does based in Hamilton. We have a few different programs. I won't go through all of it. But we do have the mental health clinic itself in downtown Hamilton. We have kind of associate counselors around the province, and we have this network called the Congregational Assistance Program. And so there's different congregations around Ontario that can basically pay a fee every year, and that congregation... is anybody that's a member of that church or attending that church can receive 6 sessions of counseling. So I don't believe this church is actually part of that right now as I'm saying that. But if you're wanting ever information about that, you can always ask me or call us and you can get more. We also have a wraparound program, which is a program that's designed to kind of support, it's just how it sounds. It's a support network for people that are maybe more vulnerable or high risk, that maybe sometimes are on the periphery. And so things like housing can be issues, things like as simple as just food access, mental health as well, but physical health needs. And so a support network of, say, doctors and social workers and counselors and all those things and volunteers. It's a volunteer-driven program to try and support people that way too. So that's another thing we do. So there's lots more, but that's a little bit about Schilling. And there's a force to be reckoned with for sure. They're bigger. They think they punch above their weight. So diving in, I want to start with just a few vignettes or short little things about what loneliness might be. So if we picture someone whose spouse has recently died, they have grown children living, say, within an hour away. But maybe busy with life and grandkids and things like that. Say somebody who no longer has a license, somebody who's retired, and they don't have a lot of people in their life. Number two, a first-year university student living in dorms, maybe a few hours from home. Maybe went to school not knowing anybody in particular when they arrived. Spends a lot of time on social media. Doesn't have a lot of interpersonal connections besides maybe going to class. Number three, say a young married father, works full-time, very busy, comes home at night, spends time with the kids, spends time with wife, very good at taking care and providing. Has few close friends, and takes part in activities, maybe watches football on the weekend. Might be a cliche, but I think there's millions of people like that. And I think that's number three. Number four, let's say somebody who's a new immigrant to Canada who speaks little English, doesn't have a support network around them, has young children who they're who are, you know, attending school and are trying to integrate into the neighborhood. And number five, somebody who, you know, was very active, had many friends, who was very busy with life, and then had a tragic spinal cord injury and spends a lot of time, you know, at home in their apartment. And they have care, the people that come in. They still have family that comes and visits, but a lot of those friends have fallen away. Girlfriend that they had, no longer part of their life. So those are five vignettes. Very different. How does that hit people when you hear those? A little sad? Familiar? Yeah. What else? Diverse, yeah. Yeah. So to paint those pictures, it helps us to think about really who are we talking about when we're thinking tonight about this. I think to destigmatize that word loneliness, because it's a really, like I said, it's a tough word. Okay. So lonely but not always alone. And those are not the same thing. I think all of those vignettes, for the most part, were people that maybe sounded like they were very alone. But quite often, we do have people around us, the university student in particular. Lots of, say, like, I remember my first year of university. There's signs for parties everywhere. There's stuff going on. There's lots of activities and things you can be a part of. But it's still very, very intimidating to walk into a room where you don't know anybody and try to connect with people and try to engage. There's all different scenarios like that where I think we can mostly relate with walking into a room where you don't know anybody, yet you're surrounded with people. People in care homes, people in schools and universities, churches, places of employment, and even those living with families are surrounded by people and can still feel profoundly alone. People with few friends can feel fulfilled. And I think we forget that. We sometimes feel like we need lots and lots of people around us, but sometimes you have very few people. But if you have one or two people that you're connecting with, that's often enough to feel fulfilled. People with vast social networks can feel empty and disconnected. And I think loneliness is, I've heard it put, I read, it can be a state of the soul, actually. And it's not necessarily what's going on around us and who is around us. But it can be that feeling of being set apart or not quite feeling like we fit in. And I think that's actually a really common feeling. Being a counselor, I have that insight that I see that side of things, that side of people that maybe we don't always talk about. I think it's far more common than we think. The other thing we're not talking about is solitude. Solitude, I think, has... When you hear that word, what do you think about? Or how does that word hit people?
Choice.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Often solitude is a choice, you're right. Yeah, quietness.
Retreat,
yeah, peace, peaceful, soul searching, yeah, often in a good way. I'm trying to think of a different word, but thanks. What else did someone say?
Content,
yeah, and I think solitude can be restorative and peaceful, and that's the difference from loneliness. Loneliness is a state that is not comfortable. It's usually something that is very unwanted and very uncomfortable. We often, too, think about busyness, and people often equate busyness with a sense of maybe belonging or a sense of purpose. And sometimes it can be, especially if you're surrounded with people. I think somebody that's working and has a fulfilling, you know, work life and people that they get along with, that can be really good. But often there's people that are very, very busy that are very alone, and we kind of go full speed, but it doesn't necessarily feel like we're connected with it. Okay, so loneliness in the news. And so this year especially, I've been searching. There's been a lot of talk about loneliness in the news. Have people been seeing that?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, every day I wake up and look at my CBC app, and so I see and I flag, or I usually save all the stories. There's been hundreds of stories this year on loneliness, and over the past 5 years it's been steadily increasing. It was around 2013 that I started, from media hits, that started to come up more and more. So as I click those, I'm just going to talk about some of these. I'm not going to read each of those, but those are just some headlines that jumped out at me. Locally, there was a survey found that 66% of Toronto residents, I think in the GTA, residents know only a few neighbors or none at all. That's kind of vague, but that's how they worded it. And actually, in a positive note, though, it said that Toronto has a much higher than average social capital. And what that means is relationships among people who live and work in a particular society that enable that society to function effectively. So I'm not sure what that means. I think maybe we don't know our immediate neighbors all the time, but we have networks greater than that as people move around and geographically. So I think that's a good sign, too. But that sign that 30 to 60%, which again is a big range, but 30 to 60% of the population identifies, a third of people say that they have two or less others that they can depend on, and a quarter say that they have no one. Often we'll think of seniors as typically at the highest rate, the highest risk of loneliness, which in some sense that makes sense intuitively. A British study has recently found, and this has been echoed in North America, that actually youth aged 16 to 24 are now more likely than any other age group to report feeling lonely. What would be some reasons for that? Any thoughts on why 16 to 24-year-old might be that range that's particularly lonely now? Yeah, so that a big transition time. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, maybe peer pressure. Potentially social media, yeah. That's where my mind went immediately, and I think we got to be cautious, and we'll talk later about that too. I'm almost 40, so I got the internet when I was 18, so in that weird gap. But yeah, I think I tend to blame social media more than maybe I should, but I do think that there's something to that. What else do we think about why that age gap? Yeah. Yeah, it tends to be a time when people scatter. So, and that is quite a huge range if you think 16 to 24 and the amount of things that you can kind of do in that period of time, going from grade, say, 10 or 11 all the way to, say, some people would be married with kids, not that often, but that could be happening in that range. So, I think just driving home that there is not one single demographic that has the monopoly on loneliness. Men in particular, and again, I see probably at least 75% of the clients that I work with in probation offices, and I realize that's a very select group of people that I'm seeing, but men and loneliness is a huge problem, and this is mirrored in the research as well. So often people will say, I'm bored, and that's often, especially for men, that's often a sign of, that's another way of saying I'm actually lonely. Again, it's a very vulnerable thing to say I'm lonely. So boredom covers it really easily. I play video games all day, or I stay home and watch Netflix all day. There's a lot of people that do that, and I think that's that lack of connection. Women are more likely, stereotypically, but I think it's true that women are more likely to prioritize and foster face-to-face relationships. I think there's a lot of that socialization that happens, but for whatever reason, yeah, men are not as good or not as adept at doing that. Another factor is that lonely people tend to blame themselves. And the lonelier and more disconnected anyone feels, the more unlikely we are to reach out to other people. So there's this element of, what's the word there? Can we think of the emotion that might be? Fear, yeah. I'm kind of looking at shame. There's this sense of shame or this sense of not belonging, again, not quite being good enough, not adding up. And I think that's, when I say that word shame, I'm really curious. What are some thoughts people have about what shame means? So we don't use that word that often, yeah. Yeah, being judged, that's a big one, yeah.
Falling short,
yeah. Yeah, there's something wrong with me, exactly, yeah.
No self-esteem.
Yeah, or low self-esteem, yeah. Yeah, intimidation, yeah. Inferiority complex, however we kind of put that. Shame is this idea of kind of setting apart. There's this saying like guilt, the difference between guilt and shame. Guilt is, you know, I did something wrong and that wasn't a good thing. And shame is kind of, I did something wrong and now I'm because of that, I'm damaged or I'm wrong. And shame can really stick to us. And shame comes from a lot of different things beyond the scope of what we can get into tonight. But the biggest piece with shame is that it causes us to isolate. It causes us to hide. And you can think of when a small child does something wrong and then they go and hide. That's like the classic shame before we've learned how to kind of cover our tracks. Last year, British Prime Minister Theresa May appointed a Minister of Loneliness as part of a campaign to end loneliness. And again, that's just showing that loneliness can impact anyone at any point in their lives. It's increasingly a health issue as well. So Research shows that the epidemic of loneliness is quickly becoming one of the biggest health issues of our time worldwide. Many visits to the doctor are, and even 15 years, well, close to 15 years ago when I did my master's, even then they were saying something like 60% of the visits to a doctor are actually just people that are lonely. There's not actually necessarily a physical need in that moment. It might feel like it, but they often would say that if there was some connection for that person, they might not be walking to the doctors. And we'll use different words for what that is, but... So, there is a zone in Italy, it's called, in Sardinia, it's called the Blue Zone, I don't know why it's called that, but it's among the world's highest rate of centenarians. And so there was research done, Susan Pinker actually did this, I don't know, is anybody familiar with TED Talks? Yeah, okay, some people watch a lot of them, some people haven't heard of them, but you can just go on YouTube and search TED Talks and you can watch them for hours. But she did, I actually encourage you to watch the one that Susan Pinker did. And she did this, she talked about the Sardinia Blue Zone and the list of factors that have the greatest impact on lifespan and the overall health. And so these are listed here in increasing importance. So that means that number 10, that end, is actually less impactful than as you work your way to 1. So clean air, believe it or not, is... of this list is the least impactful on longevity for life and health. Treatment for hypertension, body weight, and you might have heard that study, and I think I say it later, but that obesity and smoking is actually less of a health risk now than loneliness. Exercise has less impact. Cardiac rehabilitation, and I don't know how they chose each of these, but this was based on the research that she did. Having a flu vaccination, that's actually pretty high up there, though, considering a lot of people don't get them. I did this year, finally. Alcohol consumption. And if you look at, we'll talk a bit about that later, but alcohol consumption and how that relates with loneliness, potentially. Smoking. So number 2 and number 1 on the list for having actually the greatest impact on longevity and health would be having close relationships. So that means having people that you can rely on. And number 1 is actually just social integration. And that's, you know, it's a big word, but that means how much you interact with anybody. So it's actually not necessarily people that you know well. It's just that anybody that you're interacting with in any kind of situation, whether that's a cashier, whether that's walking down the street and talking with your neighbor, any of those interactions are actually incredibly valuable. So in this blue zone, it's a very, very dense area, dense kind of neighborhoods, and it's lots and lots of intergenerational people living right, basically on top of each other. Like, it's a very dense, and so what they find is, yeah, because of that integration and that intergenerational arrangement, people are really, there's a lot of benefit to that. So they've been researching that. People who are lonely have increased risk for mental health concerns, such as depression and anxiety. And you can see where substance use might come into that as people self-medicate, if we want to use that word. Interestingly, there is this idea that, well, it's not an idea. Research has shown that loneliness and physical pain actually light up the same part of the brain. So the idea that being lonely is, the brain codes that as a physical pain, if that makes sense. So that shows you how profound loneliness can feel. That has huge implications, and you can see, I don't know, is anybody familiar with Gabor Mate? Has anybody heard that name? Yeah, a little bit, yeah. So he's done a lot of research and writing. He has a few great books. In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts is a really good one. He worked in the Lower East Side in Vancouver, in East Hastings. And I think I have that right. I'm going by memory. But he is a medical doctor, but he did a lot of work with people that were struggling with profound, like, heroin addiction. And a lot of that is looking at how loneliness impacts addiction and trauma too. So you can see how if somebody is lonely and how if they're using substances, whether it's heroin or alcohol, you can see how potentially it makes sense because it's basically taking away that physical pain or numbing that out. So studies have shown that painkillers taken for physical pain have been shown to reduce the ache of loneliness. Practically, social connection of any kind improves overall physical, mental, and spiritual health. And it promotes things like healthy heart, regulated blood pressure, effective immune system, better digestion, all these things. So people even with moderate levels of social engagement have lower rates of dementia. Cancer and stroke survivors recovered more quickly when they had some type of support group. And often that appeared to work better than medication. So there's just tons and tons of research showing this. So how is that hitting people as they hear some of these things? Is a lot of this new, or is this things that people have read before? Some things that people have heard. And yeah, it's getting out there more and more. A lot of the articles that are coming out, this is the stuff that they're talking about. I guess the other piece of looking at this is from attachment. And a lot of the work that we do at Shalem is based on attachment. It's this idea that relationships and we have relationship styles that are formed early in childhood. And it's the idea that we kind of perpetuate or carry that relationship style through our lives. So there can be secure attachments, there can be insecure attachments. But the beauty is that the brain is amazingly resilient and we can learn and repair. So if we have had rough attachments younger, just a simple way of saying if we had, you know, not great care growing up for people that maybe were neglected when they were children, those things can be repaired with relationship. But it takes some work, and that's a lot of what we do as counselors too. But it doesn't need to be formal things like counseling. It can be informal, any social networks. And I think that's the hope there, is that any time we have any interaction with other people, it's really, really healing. Loneliness is not just an affliction experienced by people on the periphery. It can impact any of us at any point in our lives. So, where are we here? So there's a trend, and where are we? Sorry, I'm looking here. In the UK, there's a new trend now, and people have probably seen this now because it's been talked about here as well. Social prescribing. Doctors have begun social prescribing for their patients for things like yoga classes, book clubs, visiting art galleries, joining knitting circles. These are all things that are proving to be effective tools where research has shown that not only patients will benefit from a mental health boost, but people will end up with reduced medication and less physical ailments. So have people heard about social prescribing a little bit? Yeah? What have you heard, or what do you guys think of that? Yeah, I know Hamilton has an initiative where people will be, for people that can't drive, they'll pick them up to go to the symphony. There's that kind of thing. Or they'll have like a luncheon or that kind of thing beforehand. So to get people together and talking, and then they can go watch the symphony after. That's a good question. I think it is a city initiative, actually. Yeah, I believe so. And it's a volunteer-run. But yeah, so there's lots of different things like this happening. So taking a lead from the UK, here in Ontario, the Alliance for Healthier Communities is currently piloting a social prescribing project in 11 community health centers. And actually, Mark van der Venen, he's Shalem's executive director, he's a member of the advisory committee for that initiative. And so they're trying that here. So I think we're increasingly going to see that roll out. And as baby boomers are aging, and it's definitely not just for seniors, but definitely that's a large part of that. Yeah. Yeah, and actually that's increasingly happening too. Do you know much about that? So again, a lot more of that intergenerational contact is happening. Like my kids are grade 5 and 3, and they go visit. Yeah, they go visit the care home. So, yeah, that's a regular thing. Hop on the bus and go. Yeah. Can people think of other initiatives like that they've heard of? So there's this Anne Lamott quote. I don't know if people are familiar with Anne Lamott. She's an author that I like. But she when we spend too much time alone, we get a little strange. And it's... I use that quote a lot with clients. But what does that mean when people hear that? Any thoughts on that? Disagree? Does anybody not like that quote? Yeah, maybe a little eccentric. I think we tend to spend, when we spend a lot of time alone, we're not challenged by other people. And I think when we're with others, we gain insight into how other people think, what they believe, and even how they live. And I think you see this in families, as people have kids and their kids start to get these ideas or different lifestyles or all those things. I think then you start to actually see, okay, this isn't as simple as just surrounding myself with people that think and believe things that I do, because people push us and challenge us. I think in our jobs, we're surrounded, you're forced to be with people sometimes that you wouldn't necessarily spend time with. And I think the same in churches and the same in any kind of situation where we're around people that we wouldn't necessarily choose. Yeah, we learn and grow. Social connectedness serves as a scaffold for the self, and how it's kind of an example of how we actually do relationships. And I think when we don't have good social connection, it kind of damages that scaffold, and I think it kind of causes that idea of self to crumble as well. So I think we exist in the context of relationships. If we don't have other people around us, it profoundly shifts how we kind of feel. And I think, yeah, you can get jaded, you can get grumpy. People that spend a lot of time on social media, I think we all maybe know some of those people. It's not always healthy because you're interacting with other people in a very stunted, stilted way, and it's not necessarily real people. It's just somebody typing into the keyboard, and then you're reading what they think and getting upset, but it's not necessarily genuine dialogue. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sometimes it causes us to zone out and not pay attention to the people around us. So it's a biological imperative to know that we belong. And when we feel a sense of belonging, we feel safe, we feel secure, and we're more likely to reach out to others. So we are social animals. We're wired to connect. So now I want to take a shift. I'm just going to check the time here. As far as practical ways now, how can we decrease loneliness in our own lives and in the lives of those around us? And I think that's the focus for tonight, really. I wanted to spend some time making a case for that because I think it's really powerful. And I hope that you're starting to feel how core to our beings that is, how important attachment, how important relationship is. And I think we get that. But I think, yeah, there's lots of different reasons why that can break down and why we don't necessarily prioritize that. So that's what I want us to try and be thinking of as going through this. So building empathy, not sympathy. And I think having an outward mindset is really key. So an outward mindset, it's based on a book that I'd read. And the author, I couldn't find it. I was looking. Mark had asked us to read it a couple of years ago for a PD day. It came from, somebody had put it out, but there was no author when I looked back to see who it was. So that's why it's not listed. But if you're interested, talk to me and I'll figure out how to get it to you. But it's this idea of, it's a good name because it's just this idea of seeing beyond ourselves. It's this idea of viewing every single interaction we have with empathy. So it's asking ourselves not only how we might benefit from interaction, but how the person we're interacting with is benefiting from that, or what's the value for them in that as well. This, I'm going to speak for myself because this is where I've found it really helpful with my kids. For anybody that's been around kids, they'll sometimes get very excited and start telling you a story, and sometimes it's really hard to focus, and sometimes it's meandering and it doesn't always add up, and in your brain you're kind of, it's easy to get impatient and say, I gotta make dinner, I have to do this, I got this to do. And I think when I start to think of it in the outward mindset, I'm thinking, okay, well, why is my daughter so excited to be telling me this right now, and what is the value in me taking the time to get down on my knees and really listen to what she's saying and try to absorb it? And if you look at it that way, it's a very different experience. It causes you to savor that moment rather than to kind of rush through it and miss out on that. And I think we can use that for all sorts of things. As, you know, teachers paying attention to students, me obviously with clients, I mean, to do that job well. But there's every interaction we have can really be seen from this outward mindset. So what is the other person needing in that interaction? What might they be finding valuable? And this can be interactions not just with family and friends, but coworkers, cashiers, people that you find difficult, people that you don't agree with, neighbors, people walking their dogs, anybody. You can do this. And it's a really interesting way of kind of seeing those interactions. So I was going to play a video. I'm feeling like time-wise, maybe I won't. I think we're going to keep going. So taking advantage of interactions that you're already having. So in-person interaction is always the best. And there's some big reasons for this scientifically as well as just practically. But we're all having these interactions every day, all day long. And actually, when we have face-to-face with eye contact and actual seeing someone, being with someone, this increases things like oxytocin, which is just a chemical, or an endorphin that increases trust. And it also decreases cortisol, it decreases stress. So again, these have some really profound effects on the body and how we cope with life as well. But it's also great for building trust with other people. It's great for interacting and seeing people as positive, seeing the world as positive. I can't count the number of times I have people that say, you know, the world is going really badly right now and things are bad and things, you know, there's all sorts of reasons they have for that. And I like to counter that and say, well, what's the evidence we have for that? Are things as bad as we think? Are your interactions with people really proving to be that bad? Because I think that's a way of framing it, and there's no bearing on that. We have more information now than we've ever had. Often the news tends to be bad. There's no reason to think that things are worse than they were. And there might be people that disagree with me on that, but I think it's risky to walk around thinking that. And I think the more we interact with people and have good experiences, the more that trust builds and the more that helps us with that. So lonely people often, and I guess I didn't actually say this, but this, I think all of us, like I said, it can be any of us. And tonight is not just about talking to lonely people, and it's not just talking to people that want to help lonely people, because I think we're all part of that, depending on where we're at. We've all experienced both sides of that. And so, yeah, taking risks is another really important thing. I think if I asked you, what are the barriers that stop people from interacting, stop people from communicating with one another, what are those barriers? Yeah, so just people being shy. I think that's a big one. You're right. Fear of rejection, yeah. People just being too busy, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's times at church I want to visit with people after and I race out because my kids are yelling at me that they want to go and I really do want to visit, but sometimes it just, yeah, sometimes it's hard because we get busy. Yeah, completely. I think there's a huge fear of offending each other or saying something wrong. And I think quite often that's a big barrier too. We don't interact or we talk to somebody that looks like they might fit with our views, but it's harder to go up to. There's a lot of people we might say, oh, I wouldn't go up to that kind of person because I'm a little bit unsure that I don't want to offend them. Yeah. Yeah. So fear of talking to people with mental health issues, you mean? Yeah, again, kind of that fear of offending, that fear of saying the wrong thing, that fear of not supporting someone. Sometimes there might be a fear of also not wanting to be burdened with somebody else's problems. I think that's part of it. There are, and I talk about it in a bit, but the idea of difficult people. There's some people that do kind of sap us, and they can take a lot of our energy. And I think it's important to recognize that rather than feel guilty about it. To say, okay, there are people out there like that, and sometimes we might find ourselves are like that, and that's important to be aware of that at least to understand how to support those people too. So there's lots of different reasons why risk it is a risk to engage with people. People are unpredictable, and they can be mean sometimes. They can be harsh. Lonely people are more likely, this is just based on research again, but somebody who's lonely is more likely to pick up on negative signals from other people and that idea of what's wrong with me. Sometimes interpreting judgment and rejection where it's not intended. So if you're lonely, reach out and look for ways to contribute is another way to do that. Sometimes if you're lonely, it's saying, okay, what can I do? CBC had a really interesting kind of documentary style thing at the end of the National a few weeks ago. And it was about, they looked at a couple different people and how they were very lonely people later in life and they volunteered. And that just like brought so much purpose to their lives. I think having something to engage in, something, a reason to get up in the morning is really important. And so it's trying to figure out how to find those things. And it doesn't need to be, you know, you're not always going to have just best friends. A lot of my clients will say, I wish I just had a best friend still. And it's saying, okay, find someone. It doesn't need to be, it'd be great to have that buddy like you had in high school, but you're not going to find that necessarily. So find someone, because humans are going to interact with you if you can be around them. Yeah, I think it's also being, you know, being respectful, but also being bold and somewhat being persistent. Again, asking people what they need and what they want. And sharing about yourself is also, I think, really valuable. Because I think a lot of people, again, research shows that somebody that's lonely, often that shame piece, don't tend to share about themselves as much. They feel like they're being a burden or they're taking up time. And so if we share about ourselves, I think that kind of can open that door for other people to do that as well. Dyadic developmental psychotherapy, which is a mouthful, but this is one of the things they always talk about is pace. And it's the idea of being playful, accepting, curious, and empathetic. And I think that's a really nice way of framing how we can be with anybody. We can do that all day long with whoever we interact with. So the foundational goal of any initiative to tackle loneliness should be to decrease shame and isolation and increase connection and belonging. A couple more things I want to touch on. We're okay for time, Mark? Having a hook to connect. So focusing on people's interests and strengths is incredibly important and trying to figure out how to draw people in. So sometimes it's looking at things like what do people want? What are they interested in? What skills do they have? What are their strengths? and find a, kind of asking people, you know, what do they see the need being in the community that they inhabit? I think rather than going in and telling people what they need. And again, I'm talking about this on so many different levels. So this can be very, very informal, little micro connection with anybody. These can be bigger things like, you know, say in this context, like a church, and how do we reach out to the community as well. So there's all different ways of looking at this. So keep that in mind. But, you know, looking at things like what resources do we have? You know, things like, do we have access to a kitchen? I'll use my church as an example in Hamilton. There's actually, we call them the Pie Ladies, but they get together every week and they make pies, and they have, all we needed was, we gave them a big deep freezer like the size of this table, and they just keep that thing stocked with pies, and they love it. They get together and they hang out, and then they sell those pies like just for donation kind of stuff after. So they always have that going on. Yeah, they are good. They're amazing pies. I always keep a check in my wallet so I can buy pies. If you have a gym, somebody at our church recently started a basketball program. Not a lot of youth at our church even, but they decided to start trying to do this. And they bought, it wasn't that much, it was $300 to get it going. They just bought a couple hoops. And they started to say, okay, after the service, we're going to have anybody that wants to come play basketball. And that's actually started to pick up steam. And they're going to put up a poster in the or put up posters in the neighborhood and start trying to draw people in that way. And it's no pretext on anything. It's just to get people to come play basketball. But we got a gym, and we thought, why aren't we using this gym? And it's a very small church, smaller than this one probably. Any other skills and talents, you know, things like getting together to do, you know, knitting, if it's cycling, if it's board games, book clubs, all of those things. There's these art nights now they'll do. Well, somebody will come in, and they'll have easels, and they'll set. I don't know, has anybody participated in one of those art nights? Heard about them? Heard about them? Okay, yeah. Yeah, and they'll just set up easels and they'll just paint. And yeah, and that can be structured in different ways. My friend's sister does them. I haven't done one yet. But yeah, there's lots of those things. There's other just simple things like when you do have a group of people, in this, I don't know if I like this idea, but it was one example I'd heard where everybody that's new gets a yellow cup and then you recognize who the new people are. I don't like that because I don't like to have people stand out. But the same way I don't always like name tags. But it's the idea of just trying to get creative and try to figure out how to draw people in and engage. And I think that's really valuable. And there's so much creativity to that. These buddy benches, people have heard about those a little bit, maybe. Yeah. Some schools are starting to have a buddy bench. And I hadn't heard of this until like a month ago, which I was surprised because they're not new. But yeah, there's... Toronto's had a few, Winnipeg I know had a school that did it recently as well. They'll just set up a big colorful bench that they paint somewhere in the school, usually in a central area. And if somebody is having a rough day or they feel like they don't have anybody that they can talk to, a kid can just go sit on that bench. And signifies to anybody else, hey, come sit with me, I wouldn't mind having a chat. And they've been finding some really amazing experiences with that. CBC again had on the National that night, talked a bit about that. They had like a microphone, and they just had this kid was sitting there, and somebody else came up, and they had this really heartfelt conversation. These two kids. So all those things. I guess the other thing would be looking at people's needs. And I think sometimes we get so focused on creating things just to get people together that we don't always ask just that basic question of what is needed here. There's this idea of Maslow's hierarchy for anybody that's taken. That's just a fancy way of saying. People have basic needs first, and if people don't have food and water and shelter, there's no point in talking about all these other things up here because we need to focus on that first. And sometimes it's just focusing on, okay, what are the basic things that people need first and foremost? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, me personally? I get it, yeah. In a perfect world, I think it'd be good. I just, my own little, it was a bad joke. I don't like name tags. I personally have no professional problem with name tags. I don't know. It feels like forced fun or something. So, no, they can be great. They can be really good. I like the idea of just walking up and talking to someone and finding out their name. But the handy part for name tags is after you've asked for their name and then you forget it immediately, then you have the name tag. So maybe that's the part I like, but... I don't like the idea of walking up and reading the name tag. Yeah, thank you for clarifying. Yeah, so looking at needs. So ask people what they need, you know, and I think meeting community needs and offering practical help, you know, things like meals. And in our church, we'll do this thing where if somebody has a new baby, There's like a meal thing if somebody's sick. I know I was in the hospital for I just had like an infection a couple of years ago in my arm, and then people were bringing us meals. So just small things like that are really, really important and really valuable. And those little informal interactions are actually so much more meaningful sometimes. You get to know someone more in a five-minute chat, and they drop off a meal sometimes than being in, you know, seeing them once a week for years. Just because, yeah, we get busy. And we get in patterns where we talk to certain people. Yeah, and I think the only thing I had there, and this isn't just about churches, but, I mean, because we're in a church tonight, I think that's partly why. There is interest, like more and more talk about how churches have a really interesting place in society. They have a place where they can offer this to people. And there's lots of other places, but if you think about it, sometimes there's not that many other places that are in that same, that hold that same spot that maybe church does or faith communities do. In the sense, I have a lot of clients that, you know, didn't necessarily grow up in the church, and I don't talk about faith very often with clients. It's just not a part of the job. But a lot that happenstance will somehow stumble into a church, and they find that to be a really welcoming, meaningful place for them. And often these are people that are kind of misfit-style people, and I always, like, wonder how they're being embraced there. But it's really nice to hear when they do have good experiences when they go. So I think there's a really interesting place, a role that they can play. So anticipate different challenges and be creative. And I think, you know, having a community focus helps to avoid burnout, because I think that's a real thing that happens. There are those people that are just not always easy. And I think there's research that shows, and the reason sometimes they'll develop programs like Wraparound, which Shalem does, the reason sometimes there's social prescribing, I think, is because some people do exhaust some caregivers sometimes. And so trying to spread that out as a community, trying to anticipate that and set up, you know, sometimes you have to be structured or you have to set things up in a way where it's not just about talking, but maybe it's about doing an activity together. But yeah, getting creative with how you anticipate those challenges. And not just avoiding, because I think we tend to avoid when people are difficult. Is there any questions or thoughts right now? Using technology wisely. I don't know, what's the general thought when we talk about technology, just with phones in particular, like email and texting but Facebook and Skype, yeah. Yeah, there's often that thought that social skills are kind of being lost, maybe that face-to-face. And I think I do think there's some truth to that. Like, we don't need to interact in the same way that we used to, and I think that's something that we're losing, potentially. I mean, thankfully, we got to remember that it's not everybody. We get that all-or-nothing thing, and there's lots of people that are wonderful at interacting and love people. But I think, yeah, we are constricting a little bit. You know, even just like self-checkout. I mean, again, I know it's one of those things that we kind of rag on, but it's basic little skills like that where some people are actually very intimidated to do that and aren't needing to do that as much. Even just going out of the house. I mean, more and more now you can actually get popcorn delivered to your house to watch a movie. I just saw this the other day, and it seems so silly. Like, not even going to a theater. Not that you're interacting at a theater. I guess it would have to be, or it's not going to work. Yeah. So I think we got to be cautious on how we look at this, because it's here. It's not going away. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, online shopping and how people order three of one size so they can just try it on and send it back. You know, not to have... Yeah, yeah. Well, there was actually a story about how bad that is for the environment. There was recently, there's all these things. And I think technology isn't bad. There's some, you know, especially for those of us that grew up, you know, it's been about half my life, a little bit less than half my life now, I guess. But most of my adult life, I've had it. And a lot of people haven't. But I think just to look at it is here, and how do we embrace it, and how do we use what we have wisely? Because that's important. So there is actually... there's a new startup, and I don't know the name of the company, but they're experimenting with having tailored text messages that get sent out to clients. And it's actually a paid service that people do. It's down in the States. But it's just to have those texts for people just to motivate and inspire and get them to engage. And so looking at that, as if that's all you have, that's not enough. But if that's a way to get you out of the house, that's really important. For some clients that I work with who are depressed, I'll say, okay, what if when one of the things you do is if you're feeling really low, you call someone, and all you do is have a brief conversation. It doesn't have to be about how you're feeling. Just call and say hello. whether it's a family member or a friend. And I think for some people that causes a shift in the brain, and it allows them to kind of, once you hear that human voice on the phone, it helps you to remember that, yeah, you are part of a corporate thing. You're able to engage with other people. So even just texting, and I think there's lots of little ways we can do that, right? Just text, and when you think of someone, just say, how's your day going? And those are small things, but those are valuable things, and you can do that with anybody that you know. We feel like maybe that's not like a long conversation on a phone call, not an email, but actually it can be really meaningful to do those things. So try to get creative and see technology, you know, as much as we can see those problems, but try to use it wisely and foster those relationships. So, that is all the material that I have as far as that goes. And I think Mark was going to come up and Hank was going to come up as well to kind of have a discussion about how this can be, you know, practiced and how a lot of this material can be incorporated to really have some, you know, if we use the word initiatives, that sounds very formal. But, you know, like I said, this can be really formal or informal, but ways of drawing people in and recognizing how to fight loneliness. So did you guys want to come up, or what were you, like the large building next door, to be able to draw people in somehow? They're there, and there would definitely be people that would come if they engage. It's great, just having coffee and having no other pretext, no reason, just to say, hey, let's get together, and if people come, great. My in-laws, actually, they live with us, so I have that corporate living kind of thing. I'm fortunate to have that, but they, at their church, they've been doing that now. They
delivered,
okay. Just what they are interested in. Just to get them talking. I think just to have them realize that you are, like, relatable. You want them to see that you're a human being as well, you know. And I remember being that age, clearly having, you know, people come up to me, and I remember them trying really, like, looking back now, I realize they were trying really hard to interact, and I didn't really reach back. I just wasn't in the mood, or it was whatever the risk, or I'm not sure. But I remember that really clearly being on that side of the divide. So, I think there's only so much you can do, but I think if you can, you know, humor is always really powerful if you can do that. But I think the last thing you can do is try too hard. I mean, if they sense that you're trying too hard to be cool or trying to match that, I don't think that works. I think most people know that intuitively, but yeah,
ask,
relationship.
Ask them if they can do something.
I know. I mean, I think I'm much older than some you folks here, but, you know, you can't find common ground on some stuff. I can't even follow it. I'm not going to try even. You know, I do my own thing on the computer. But ask, show them that you need them for something. Small things, do something, and then they start talking. It's a bit like when you used to do before the dishwashers, if you could remember that far back. You know, a good time was had when I did the dishes with my kids. And they talked. We did something together. It's very simple.
From Capstone Church. I meant to mention you earlier as well. I've been talking about churches. Something I learned one time, I took my teenage son, he was a younger teenager at the time, so thinking about kids, I took him out because I knew he liked ice cream, so we went and got ice cream. We had a miserable time, just a miserable time, staring at each other over ice cream, and I was trying to get conversation going. We got in the car on the way home. Now we're both facing straight. We had a great talk on the way home.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just the physical stance, especially with boys, right? You can't be looking them in the eye, right? And that's why dishes works a lot of time, right? You're both looking that way. Margaret?
Your questions and different types of people like to talk about themselves. And I think they're curious to talk. And so I think if you ask good questions, sometimes that's a real good in. And it might be just a quirky, ridiculous question, but just to try and allow them to use their brain and creativity and answer.